This is an ABC podcast.
Last month, Pope Francis admitted for the first time that sexual abuse by priests against religious women exists. Today, you will hear Australian perspectives on the ripples of the Nuns Too movement. And an internet pastor, a sing-along congregation, and even a Bible study group, how you can hold a church in the palm of your hand. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. I'm Kumi Taguchi, hosting this week for a special International Women's Day edition. First, to one of the most talked about events this week. International Women's Day comes and goes each year, and on that day we talk about women's achievements, political, social, educational, and spiritual. And this year's theme, Balance for Better, is a nod for making a positive difference for females. But my next guest says that movements like these have repeatedly fallen short in adequately addressing women's grievances in some parts of the world. She calls it a happy, not so, International Women's Day. Noha Abueldahab joins me from Qatar, where she is visiting fellow at the Brookings Doha Centre. Noha, welcome.
Thank you.
Why is it not so happy in your view?
Well, I think that there's a crisis of solidarity, really, in the sense that International Women's Day has mainly been sort of dominated by Western narratives of women's rights. When you look at, for example, stories about the plight of women in other parts of the world, they're mostly stories about having to do with image, for example. You know, these women are oppressed because they wear the hijab, for example. And so they significantly overlook the plight and the grievances of these women that extend way, way beyond that. But they also ignore instances where women, and there are many, many, many of them, have chosen to wear the hijab, who want to wear it and don't want to take it off, but they experience other forms of oppression and violations and discrimination. So I think that International Women's Day, broadly speaking, really does fail to acknowledge and sort of provide this kind of solidarity and support for women from diverse contexts.
So what would an International Women's Day look like, sitting from the perspective of a woman sitting in the Middle East somewhere, potentially from a more diverse context, as you speak about? What would they be saying, this is what we want to see championed?
Well, you know, it depends on the country and the context, really. I think it's very important to lend support and solidarity to grassroots level campaigns in each context, in each country. It differs really from Egypt to Yemen to Saudi Arabia to Tunisia. It's difficult to speak of specific demands for equality that apply across the board, but certainly the violations that are experienced, I suppose, are quite universal. But the plight of women in these contexts really differs. Just to give you an example, you know, we saw recently this big story about a young Saudi woman who fled Saudi Arabia and ended up being received by Canada. You know, she was complaining about being discriminated against in her home in Saudi Arabia and being abused, etc. Now, many other Saudi women who are also oppressed and suffer much more serious violations, not to discredit whatever Rahaf had been through, don't want to leave their country. They want to stay in the country that is their home and that they love, and they want to continue to fight for a better status, a more equal status, and to fight against the violations that they experience. I don't think that plight or that kind of cause is supported enough by those who dominate the International Women's Day narrative.
So is that narrative coming from those who do set the narrative, you know, for International Women's Day, or is that a failure on behalf of the media as well, particularly Western media, of not delving into these issues more broadly?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that the media does play a very, very major role here. You'll often see stories about women who en masse, you know, took off their headscarf and were, you know, all of a sudden liberated for taking off this piece of clothing on their head. And you'll see very sort of lengthy stories, passionate stories about such instances, but you wouldn't see stories really in the media about Yemeni women, for example, and the absolute mess that they are in because of the war, obviously, the disastrous humanitarian situation that they suffer on a daily basis as a result of, well, a very, very, very patriarchal global structure that they continue to struggle against on a daily basis, whether it's the war, whether it's the bombing, all sorts of horrible crimes that are perpetrated and perpetuated by both Middle Eastern countries and the West.
In an article you've written, actually, speaking about this sort of patriarchal power structures, you quote Yasmin El Rifaa from the Middle East Institute, explaining that sexual violence against Arab women is almost always attributed to Islam and Arab culture, as opposed to that patriarchal power structures that adversely affect women in the rest of the world. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, I mean, as somebody who has lived in, I think, 7 different countries, including Egypt and Saudi Arabia, Canada, the UK, France, etc., these are very different countries. I completely agree with Yasmina Rafai's point there, in that there's a very sort of superficial understanding and really, in some cases, just an unwillingness to really understand properly the kind of grievances that women in countries such as Egypt suffer. And as she said, it's as though they have no agency from the perspective of the West in particular. And so, you know, I think that the example that she gave about women in Egypt taking matters into their own hands, you know, because the state is, of course, complicit and because they live under a, you know, authoritarian rule. So they don't have the same avenues for redress as other women in the West, for example, may have by, you know, accessing the judiciary and sort of legal avenues for redress. They don't have that in countries such as Egypt and Saudi Arabia, and, you know, we can list a whole bunch of others. And so I think that, you know, instead of making the assumption that Arab women cannot speak or have no agency, I think we really need to think about the contexts within which these women have to struggle, whether it's war, famine, brutal dictatorships. And as I said, not all repressed women want to leave their country to save themselves. So if there were meaningful solidarity with, or even just a willingness to think critically about the plight of women in diverse, and in particular non-Western contexts, then I think proper attention would be paid to the underlying issues of corruption, patriarchy, and the lack of avenues for redress.
And is this what you point towards and draw attention to, this importance of intersectional feminism?
Yes, I think the intersectionality of these issues is crucial. That word is thrown about quite a bit now. It's almost lost its meaning, but it is still quite important, I think, to recognize not just the various layers of oppression that women face, but also variety and resistance. And this goes back to Yasmina Rafai's article as well, and the examples that she gave there of resistance to sexual harassment in Egypt.
Noha, we do see some positive stories coming out of some parts of the Middle East as well. I'm thinking of Tunisia's new constitution, including equality and women's political recognition. That's a pretty big step forward, is it not?
Yes, we have seen that and many other examples of positive steps with regards to, you know, the status of women in the region, but also in the U.S. now with more female Congress members and so on. So it is important to highlight these good news stories. But I think we should also be cautious and really try and understand, you know, is this a ploy by these governments to, you know, show the international community, look, we are very progressive, and we're letting our women drive, and we're, you know, giving them equality in inheritance laws, or equality in employment laws, to hide other deeper, very structural inequalities. And Tunisia is actually a very good example of this, because despite the fact that they've been applauded for passing these gender laws, there are some very big problems that remain in Tunisia, including corruption, torture, the imprisonment of activists and bloggers and journalists who express themselves and say things that, you know, don't please the government. And so I think it's very important to highlight the good news stories, but to also remind everyone that there are deeper problems that persist.
Well, Noha Abu El Dahab, it's been such a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Noha Abu El Dahab is a visiting fellow at the Brookings Doha Centre. Noha is author of Transitional Justice and the Prosecution of Political Leaders in the Arab Region. And this is the Religion and Ethics Report. You may recall an interview we did recently about how nuns, in Asia and Africa in particular, ended up cooking, ironing and scrubbing floors for cardinals. And now comes a movement drawing attention to the sexual abuse of women religious at the hands of male clerics. It's called the Nuns Too movement. Last November, a group of female theologians held a press conference in Rome to share their own stories of abuse. And just last month, Pope Francis publicly acknowledged the scandal of priests and bishops sexually exploiting nuns. So how are the ripples of the Me Too and Nuns Too movements being felt by women religious in Australia? Reporter Siobhan Hegarty spoke to Sister Trish Madigan. She's the chair of the Council for Australian Catholic Women.
I think that most women in the Catholic Church feel that they haven't been heard, and there's been a high level of frustration and anger and disappointment. But I think that we are now in a new phase. The Me Too movement is opening up areas that were perhaps hidden before and opening up new opportunities for women to have their voices heard. And I think this is actually happening in the Catholic Church at the moment.
Sister Madigan joined the Dominican Sisters of Eastern Australia 30 years ago. She's witnessed waves of change in her order and others. But she says the Me Too movement has brought structural inequality to the forefront of people's minds.
For example, the Catholic Church employs 220,000 people in various agencies across Australia, with more than 77% of that workforce made up of women. But where women's influences seems to peter out is when it comes to the official leadership of the church and the decision-making and governing and teaching structures of the church.
Despite her optimism for the future, Sister Madigan says the Catholic Church still suffers from a power imbalance. And that imbalance is at the heart of the abuse crisis.
Well, I think abuse is a lot wider than sexual abuse. And I think there is abuse of women throughout our whole society, in that women's contribution is not valued as much as men's contribution. Women are not paid as much. Women don't have the same access to power, even in our secular society, in politics and so on. So that is also mirrored in church life. So it's not unique to church life. I think wherever there is an imbalance of power, you're going to find abuse. There's economic abuse, there's societal abuse, there's sexual abuse. I think that these areas of abuse might become more evident as time goes on, in the kind of dialogue that's begun now in our society and in our church.
But not everyone believes the Catholic Church as a whole is taking responsibility for the abuse of women religious. Kathleen McPhillips is a senior lecturer in the School of Humanities and Social Sciences at the University of Newcastle, and she's been following the Me Too and Nuns Too movements closely.
Well, what happened in November last year was that a group of women met in Rome. They came together to discuss their common experiences of sexual abuse at the hands of male clerics. Most of them have been, or still are, women religious. So they belong to different orders and so on. They held a press conference. As I understand it, none of the bishops attended it.
What does this say about the Catholic Church's willingness to hear the stories of women but act upon them?
Well, it's very worrying. And I think the whole way that that summit was organised was very problematic. I mean, all the presidents of the bishops' conferences in all the dioceses around the world were gathered, so it was a momentous gathering, yet they did not meet survivors.
Sister Monica Kavanagh, congregational leader for the Sisters of St. Joseph, also watched the proceedings. While she's heard of cases of abuse in orders overseas, the stories revealed in Rome still shook her.
Particularly, I was really moved and shaken by the story of one woman who said, like, she had been abused and had to front up for 3 abortions. I found that really devastating. Mm-hmm. So I know when I've met with congregations across the world, this is an issue that we're really trying to give voice to at this time.
The abuse of women religious in Australia remains largely unspoken about, but Sister Kavanagh says that doesn't mean it hasn't occurred.
Look, I think there would be some individual women who have actually spoken about their cases. Perhaps it hasn't gone into the public arena. I know some who were in, you know, became involved in the Royal Commission hearings. And so it's something that we as congregational leaders would be mindful of.
According to Kathleen McPhillips, the abuse of women religious at the hands of male clerics is a long-standing issue in the Catholic Church.
In 1994, there was an Irish nun, Mara O'Donoghue, who put together an international report about the abuse of women religious across the globe, and that was just shelved. So nothing ever came of that until a book was published in 2010 that raised the issue of that report again. So a lot of people never even knew about that report, but it certainly exists, and it documented numerous cases across the globe, in Africa, in Asia, in Europe.
It's interesting, we've been hearing stories of abuse and trauma from women religious internationally, but here in Australia, it remains to be quite a taboo topic that hasn't been spoken about in the public domain so far. Why do you think this is so?
I think it is just a very difficult topic to talk about. I mean, talking about sex in the Catholic Church is incredibly difficult anyway, because it's such a repressive discourse to talk about the body, to talk about sexuality. There are people who are researching it, and there is a narrative about it, a discourse, but it is, as you say, it's very hidden.
Sister Kavanagh and Sister Madigan both declined to comment on whether they know of Australian women who've been sexually abused by male clerics, but they agreed that women religious have traditionally held a subordinate role in the Catholic Church. Here's Sister Kavanagh.
When we talk about the hierarchical structure, probably the bishops, the priests, were held in high regard within communities. And at that time in life, we probably even thought that they were more graced because of their position. But of course, through the Vatican Council, we became to realise that everyone has is equally chosen to do their part wherever they find themselves. However, it doesn't actually play out necessarily in lots of circumstances within the church. So I myself probably would feel that, like, I have a significant role as a congregational leader. However, when it gets to high decision making in the church, I can add my advice or my interest or whatever, but I'm not there at the table making final decisions.
But thanks to movements like Me Too and now Nuns Too, things are beginning to change.
I am the church as much as the system. I'm probably a person who believes that if you want to change something, you need to do it from inside. There would be other women, and I respect them, and I think they're fantastic too, who say the only way we can change is to move beyond. But I would come from a place of actually saying, well, I believe in order to change the situation, I need to work from within it.
Reporter Siobhan Hegarty speaking to Sister Trish Madigan, Chair of the Council for Australian Catholic Women. It used to be that church was somewhere you went on a Sunday, perhaps in a building with stained glass windows, with an altar and an organ. But these days, you can hold the church in the palm of your hand. There's an internet pastor. You can sing along to worship songs with the congregation and even join a Bible study group. And if you prefer to visit a black church, you can do so on Facebook. And as Manu Bobo reports, social media sites like blackplanet.com have led the way in providing a platform where secularism and spirituality can coexist on the same website.
I think that religion and social media is at an all-time high. And the reason that it's at an all-time high is because everybody has some type of social media device at this point because of how convenient it is with smartphones.
Sydney sider Malik Dixon is originally from North Carolina. He points out that the internet has become a fertile place for people to strengthen their religious identity.
People just want to be connected to people. So if you don't go to that class reunion, you can always be connected to everyone in that class through a situation like Facebook or Instagram. Religion has tapped into that now. It actually has morphed. Like, you got like online churches. Like, it's so many churches. If you've never been to a black church, you can actually go to a black church on Facebook now. You can just go live.
The reason the devil hates you is way back in eternity past, he used to be in charge of worship up in heaven. But because wickedness and iniquity was found in him, God fired him, and he hates you because you got the job.
That's an excerpt from a sermon posted on Facebook by Bishop T.D. Jakes, who has a massive presence on social media. He's one of a host of savvy pastors who use social media to broaden their reach, preaching Christianity to millions across the world. Religion has existed online since the days of dial-up internet. And social networking sites like Black Planet have been trailblazers in providing a space where a secular online community can exist alongside a religious one. Malik Dixon has been a member of Black Planet and says the forums on the site canvass a range of topics.
Politics, what was actually happening in America at the time with the police brutality, that was some of the things that were going on around, and then religion, of course, because black people have an intrinsic need for religion. So religion is always going to be a part of whatever form most black people gravitate towards, whether that be school, recreation. There's a recreation, there's a prayer. Most black teams do prayers before the game, before they eat. So religion was definitely a part of Black Planet.
There are so many different religions. Was there one that dominated on Black Planet?
Well, Christianity is the biggest religion amongst African Americans. And Christianity has developed art. So that art being gospel music. And gospel music is very, very important in African American culture.
Let me hear you make some Holy Ghost crazy noise right now. Let me hear.
Malik Dixon says gospel singers like Kirk Franklin could be found on Black Planet in one way or another. Some performers had their own pages on the site, while fans could embed music by their favourite artists on their personal page. Rappers for some, gospel singers for others.
Come on, all God's people, come on, Mike.
You're not Christian yourself. You're a Muslim.
Right.
So did you have forums where...
Yeah, African Americans... and Islam are connected as well. So, like I said, religion, whether it be Christianity, we got black Jews, we got black Muslims, black Christians. So, all the Abrahamic faiths.
Black Planet was created in the United States in 1999 for black people to connect worldwide. It gives users the tools to meet and socialize. One of the co-founders, Omar Wasso, has even been given some credit for introducing the internet to then talk show host Oprah Winfrey.
It was like learning a whole new language.
What's a link?
A link is a hook 'em up.
A hook 'em up that you get through the click 'em.
That's right, you get through the click 'em.
Once we had the basics going down, like the click 'ems and the hook 'ems, we could not wait to check our email for the very first time.
Okay, this is big.
While the religion and spirituality forums have been some of the most popular on Black Planet, it's not what Black Planet is known for.
In America, Black people find the need for safe spaces. And one of those safe spaces exists online as well, where we can talk about our particular needs and our particular interests. And Black Planet provided that platform.
It's also a place where you can find a date.
It was kind of like one of those things where it was like a gallery of females in a particular area or males in a particular area. And then you just went shopping. Also, it was always good. Like if you were going on a trip, you could search people in that area and just figure out what's going on and, you know, see, you know, what the local scene looks like in every area, even overseas. You actually have a lot of Black Planet members here in Australia as well that aren't Black.
But it's been a long time since Malik Dixon used Black Planet.
MySpace kind of ate Black Planet. And then what happened was Facebook came and cannibalized MySpace. And then Facebook merged with Instagram so that Instagram wouldn't cannibalize Facebook.
There's been a sudden resurgence of people searching for their Black Planet logins after singer-songwriter Solange Knowles used Twitter to announce she's back on the site.
I'm from Houston, and my dad loved geography and travel, and he just gave me a pretty worldly name. He had no idea I was going to end up living in Sydney, and my name is spelled S-Y-D-N-Y-E.
Sydney Allen is at a picnic in Newtown in Sydney's Inner West. It's been a while since she was a member.
Black Planet to me was sort of early days of the internet, right? It was like a gathering space for Black people to connect around events, culture, topics, meeting people who shared ideas with you. And I feel like it's more of when forums, like the online forums and chat groups, were a bigger thing than, say, like direct messaging, and it predated like Facebook and Instagram and things like that.
Mawuse Ziegbe is also at the picnic in Newtown. She says her Black Planet page probably still exists, but she hasn't logged in for at least a decade.
I stopped using it primarily because of Facebook, I would say. So I think, like, I was probably using Black Planet and Facebook around the same time, a little bit in college. And then Facebook took over, and Facebook was, at the time it was limited to my school, so I think it was a little bit more relevant. I wasn't meeting strangers. And then a lot of people started getting on it more. So like once it started going beyond schools and became more open, everyone was getting on Facebook, so I was like, I'll just meet people there.
She believes Black Planet paved the way for sites like Facebook.
I think Black Planet was quite progressive and quite ahead of its time. Even when I think back to what social networking is, I don't think we called it that, but you could really express yourself through your page, and, you know, you didn't have to be like a genius to, you know, really just make some sort of decorations, and you really could meet a lot of people, and it felt like a safe space.
Like Black Planet, Facebook might not be known for religion, but if you want to connect with a church online, it could possibly be one of those unlikely places to start.
Reporter Manu Bobo with that story. You can find us at the ABC Listen app and the RN website. I'm Kumi Taguchi. Andrew West will be back next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.